Okay, right. My name is Donald Madden. I'm an alcoholic. It's going to make Rodeo on Friday night like a picnic. And I'm 16 years sober on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, just, and that's absolutely boggling to me. And I'm one of the ones that got to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me to play with the winners, and the winners to me are people who had 30 days. People were winners to me who had 3 days. I had reached that point where there was no staying sober, where I was not able to stay sober, and you're seeing a psychiatrist 3 times a week, and you can't explain to him, because he's not an alcoholic, that it has nothing to do with anything else, but you cannot stay sober. I got here the great way. I got here mindless. So what I did know was that you were people who stayed sober, and what I did know finally in my life was I didn't have the answers, and I was mindless enough not to have any questions. I just came on board. I had been evicted from a sanitarium. Which is the final rejection. And because I still had money enough, or somebody had money enough, to pay for the sanitarium. And psychiatrist evicted me because he kept saying to me, "You've got to leave." And I finally, one morning, because I saw him every morning when I was in there, I had been in there 23 times, why did he want me to leave? And he said, "Because I very honestly feel you're one of those people that if you don't leave almost immediately, you may never face the world again, and you're going to be sitting facing a wall for the rest of your life." And I sat there, nearly mindless, but what my mind did say sitting there to me was, "That's awfully dramatic." I didn't realize how dramatic it was till I got sober and came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had not been in rooms full of people, and I mean any people, for a long, long time. That psychiatrist couldn't even keep me in a group therapy session with 4 people. I would split. I came into these rooms full of noise and insanity and people, and I didn't understand. What all I understood was that you were the people who knew how to stay sober, and what I wanted was to stay sober. I didn't come in here committed to sobriety on a daily basis. I came in here with a commitment to sobriety. I heard everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous talking about one day at a time, and that was too much for me. I mean, I found myself panicking and going insane brushing my teeth, because my head would move from the teeth into the cigarette and the shoes and the shoelaces and walking across the floor and the coffee, and I went insane. So what I found I had to do, and if your commitment is to sobriety, you always find the way to do it just so you don't go insane. What I found I had to do was use my head like it should be used. And what I did when I was brushing my teeth was I would brush my teeth while I was brushing my teeth while I was brushing my teeth. And when I walked across the floor terrified of what might happen at the other side of the room, I would say to myself, "All you are doing is walking across the room while you are walking across the room. It may not be there when you get to the other side." I had never all my life felt a part of anything, any place. It took me a long time and a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous to feel like I belonged here. And I don't mean as an alcoholic. I mean just to know that I belonged in these rooms, that this wasn't your podium and this was not your book and this was not your program, that it was mine too. And that I had as much right to be here as you did. And the thing that worked for me was I was used to working for what I wanted. I had been jilted off a gold platter when I was very young, and I went to work when I was 16. And I went to work for $25 a week, and I wanted it all, and I wanted it all right now. And what I had going for me was I was already an alcoholic. And that's what did it for me. And I worked. And I worked 6 days a week, and I worked 7 days a week, and I worked 15 hours a day, and I got it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in an 18-room house with three servants, too frightened to walk in the hallway because I might run into one of them. And, I had always understood working for what I wanted and going after it. I heard a man say in my first year that we come in here wrapped the same. And I hated to hear it. Because I thought there was some miracle that happened with sobriety. I mean, when you come through the nightmare I'd come from to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought just the fact of sobriety would change me and change it and change my life and change the world. And what I was faced with sober was me. What I have survived for 16 years is me. And that it was a lot tougher than anything I survived before getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never looked at me, I had never looked at the world, I had never understood, I had never had real interaction, I had never had one-to-one relationships, and I didn't know it. I had just gone after what I wanted, when I wanted it, how I wanted it, and ricocheted off every wall in life just to get what I wanted. I didn't know when I got here this was a new beginning. I thought it was the end. I thought it was all over. I don't even know, except for that strange spark that's inside every one of us that wants to live, because that's what I came here to do. I didn't come here to get anything back, and I didn't come here to get anybody back. I came in here just to survive, and I thought it was all over. I thought I would never ever have anything or anybody or ever again. And the fortunate thing that did happen for me within the confines of Alcoholics Anonymous is I was a mess. I weighed 145 pounds, and I was supposed to lose all my teeth, and the reason I didn't was the dentist said, "Who is your doctor?" And I said, "I don't have one. I have a psychiatrist." So he looked at me strangely, and he called the psychiatrist, and he came back in the room, and he said, "I must feel obligated to tell you what he said to me." And I just looked at him, and he said, "For God's sakes, don't pull any of his teeth. That's all he's got going for him." The reason I hated to hear it was, it was all I had going for me. I was one of those ones that stood nailed to the wall, smiling. And because my head did not work, and I seldom knew what I was being asked, I had to have pat answers. And the basic pat answer was, "Just fine." So if anyone said, "How are you?" I said, "Just fine." I mean, I had sat in that psychiatrist's office those last 3 years as I was going down the tubes. And it wasn't just that I would sit in hostile silence, which I did many times for 45 minutes. It's that I didn't have the answer he was asking for. He would ask me, "How are you?" And I would spend the time, when I did, telling him how it was. I tell him what was going on in my life. I didn't know how I felt about anything. I had never asked myself how I felt about anything. I had never asked myself how I felt about anybody. I just went after what I wanted. It had nothing to do with how I was feeling about it. Did I like it? Did I like doing it? Was I comfortable with those people? what was happening to my life. I never asked myself that. When I got sober, I started to have to ask myself, because I didn't understand what they were saying when they said that my sobriety was predicated on a certain kind of comfort. And I had to start getting some kind of comfort inside, because what was happening to me sober, which was why the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked for me, is I was going insane. I was coming apart at the seams, and I didn't understand how I could be sober and be coming apart at the seams. And I knew I was going insane. I had no way of turning off the 28,000 ticker tapes in my head and my head telling me constantly, it isn't, it won't be, it can't be, it never will be, and you're dead and you're done, and why do you bother? I had no way of turning it off. I had never had to turn it off. I had always had booze, and at the end of it, a pocket full of pills. And because when the booze really stopped working so I could function, the psychiatrist finally found something that worked for me, and it was a 250 milligram sleeping pill. And which I was his first alcoholic patient. I had 3 open-ended prescriptions out running, and I was taking 15 or 20 a day just so I didn't have to drink. Because drinking had finally terrified me and terrorized me, and I never knew where one drink was going to take me. I didn't know whether it was going to take me to bed for 3 days or 5 days, and I never knew when I woke up how long I had been there. And I wasn't able to function, and my whole ability of being in your world was that I had to prove myself as a moneymaker and prove myself at whatever I did. At the last of it, I was, and it was the last 3 years, I was doing, among a great many other things, a syndicated newspaper column, and that was being published. It started off in 65 papers, and I think it ended up in like 140, 150, 160 papers, and it took interviews. And I used to go on the interviews, and I had always had a mind that had total recall, and so I used to pretend to take the interviews down. And suddenly I was having to write the interviews down. And then suddenly I couldn't read my handwriting. And then suddenly I couldn't remember having been there. And the last 2 years of that newspaper column, I wrote it mostly in the Nut House. And I would get well enough one more time, and I'd call the office and say, send in my typewriter and send in the briefcase. And I'd open up this briefcase and I would look at what was in it, and I couldn't remember any of it. And the name of that newspaper column was called A Talent for Living. And I was the great judge, you see. I was a great judge of looking at other people's lives and telling everybody else in the world what they did right in their lives that was interesting. Things that you should do because they did it. And it was a celebrity newspaper column. And it was a real patsy newspaper column. I have written a newspaper column sober, I think primarily because I said I would never write again. And I think that when we're told never to say never, it's a spiritual word, you know. It's like you say it, and it goes up for the black ball. I mean, every time I have ever said never, I have always had to do it. And I remember the phone call came in one night about 6:30, and an editor said to me, would you possibly be interested in doing another newspaper column? And I said, what I had learned in here, which is how I live my life out there, God help me, I said, yes. My natural thing is to say no to practically everything. I had learned to say yes in here to give myself a chance at life. I had learned to say yes in here because I had found that saying yes in here put me where I belonged, when I was supposed to be there, to hear what I was supposed to hear. And so I said yes, and she said, what kind of a newspaper column will you do? I need to know by tomorrow morning. And I said, I'll call you at 11 o'clock tonight. Is that too late? And she said, no. And I was going off to do a speaker question and answer meeting. And I came back, and I called her on the phone, and I said, I'll do a question and answer newspaper column. And I gave her some prototypes, and it ended up in a new Sunday supplement. And I wrote most of the questions myself. And... because this was not a patsy newspaper column, and what I got mostly in the mail were rebuttals. And It was a very good newspaper column because it was me. It was a column. I couldn't believe it because when I started to read what they were publishing that I had written, it was really who I was and how I thought and how I talked and what I really believed about the whole world of architecture and the whole world of decoration and the whole world of landscaping and every cockamamie bastard in it. And including builders' wives who choose the chandeliers. I have recently read one of them, and I thought to myself, Jesus, this sounds like it was written by a drunk. And because what the question was that I had not written, some lady wrote in and said, you're always talking about wallpaper. And whenever anybody asks you about wallpaper, you're always saying either don't use it or use it sparingly. And why do you feel that way? And the answer, I mean, I read the answer. I can't believe they published the answer. The answer was, most people think of Adam and Eve with fig leaves, when actually they were standing there naked. Now, that was published in the Santa Ana Register. For all the orange pickers, right? I mean, I think essentially for someone who had always been terrified of what everybody else had to say about him, that whether I am sometimes or not doesn't make any difference, because what I have found in here is a lot of examples of how to stand up and be who I am. And the people I admired in Alcoholics Anonymous were the ones who stood up and were honest at the podium in here and had the courage to stand up in a room full of people like this. And it's where I've gotten all my courage, is by looking at other people in here and people who were willing to do whatever the hell they did in here to stay sober and reach out to other people and do all those things. And it's, I suppose, in essence, because I had no place else to pattern my life after anything. I mean, I grew up with absolutely probably no other values in the world except money, because it's what who my family were. I mean, they had been that for generations. They had always gone after the money and eaten their children. And those are the values I had. And I didn't understand any other values. When I got sober, I thought I had to get it together all at once. And I went to a party one night, and some drunken guy walked up to me and said, you're Donald Madden, aren't you? And I said, yes. And I didn't even recognize him. And he said, what are you doing now? And I said, nothing. And he said, you must have ended up with a lot of money. And I said, I didn't. And he said, well, I want to say one thing to you. Yours was the most despicable use of the greatest creative talent I think I've ever known. And I said to him, you don't know me well enough to say that. And it gave me a headache for 2 days. And because underneath, I knew that he knew me well enough, obviously, to say it, because it was the truth. It was how I had run my life. I had nothing to do with creativity in me. I had gone for the money. I went for the money. And I used whatever it was I had to get the money. No one had ever told me, ever, that the name of the game in life was to go after it and find yourself. And find out what you love doing and doing it. And that if you did that, you'd make money from it. That happened to me sober, because when I got sober, I didn't know what I was going to do. It was over. When I went to, something had dawned on me, the 23rd time, that it wouldn't work if I went back again, right? And another alcoholic from that sanitarium, his family took me in, and he got drunk. And so they threw him out, and I stayed. So they ended up with this sober alcoholic stranger in their house, and I felt totally cast adrift and totally without a place and totally without friends. I had no way of making a living. I did not know that I was so sick I couldn't have made a living anyway if you'd given it to me, which was why I wasn't given it. I came into this program with absolutely no spirituality. I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer, so I had no handle. I had nobody. I had never, ever been able to talk to anybody and tell anybody anything. I didn't know what was going on inside me anyway, but I had never even told anybody any facts of my life. I hadn't gone underground when I was a kid. I had gone underground during divorce suits and unfit mother cases, and I had just gone underground and started to drink when I was 14, period. And that's where it stopped. I had never, ever told anyone anything. I just talked a lot. And so when I got here, I didn't know how to talk to anybody, and I didn't know what I was feeling. I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know how to make any money, and I didn't know how sick I was. What I wanted was sobriety, which is what you had. My fantasy and my fear was so great that I didn't hear the word slip in Alcoholics Anonymous for almost a year. Because the fact of the matter was, if you slipped, my fear was so great that if I would accept the fact that you slipped, there was a possibility I might. And I couldn't accept that possibility. I had to believe this worked. I didn't know how to work it. I didn't know what it was, and it didn't make any difference. I could not read, so they kept saying, read the big book, and I didn't say anything to anybody. In my second year, I taught myself to read one sentence at a time. I would not go on to the third sentence until I could put the two together and remember them. What I did in here was I washed coffee cups. I was always in a meeting an hour early. I never left a meeting till the last person. And it wasn't because I was wonderful, it was because I was so terrified out there I couldn't wait to get here. And I was so terrified of leaving to go out there again that I wanted to stay and not go home. I used to cry all the way home every night. I'd walk out the doors of these rooms smiling, and I'd get in that car and cry all the way home. And I didn't know where all of you went between meetings. I mean, they told me to get telephone numbers, and I must have had 100 telephone numbers, but I didn't call anybody. And I made my first call for help. I had never asked for help in my entire life. I had gone after it always and gotten it and gotten what I wanted and never asked you for anything. I didn't know that it was all right. I thought if I told you I was wounded, if I knew I was wounded, that you might throw me away. I mean, I didn't know what happens after you say hello. I mean, I didn't know that with alcoholics, all you had to say to them is, how are you? And then listen for 45 minutes. And they might end up the conversation without even asking you how you were. I didn't know that. And I remember I was three or four months sober. And I had a head that wouldn't stop and was insane with words going through, and I couldn't sleep, and it was going. And one night I slept for a few hours and I woke up and it was silent. My head was silent. And I thought my mind had slipped. I thought perhaps what happened was that the pressure had been so great my mind had caved. So I made my first phone call, and I explained the situation to this lady, who spent the next hour trying to make me understand that what I was feeling was quiet and the first edge of peace and the first edge of comfort, because I had never had that. I mean, it's easy, I suppose, to sell what Alcoholics Anonymous has for you, if you've had it someplace. I heard them talking about emotions that I had never had and had never been mine. So I had nothing to relate to it when they're talking about quiet. when they're talking about peace, when you're talking about comfort, when you're talking about an ability to live in the world with other people and allow other people to be who they are, I didn't know what they were talking about. I had lived life like a fist. I had been at war all my life. I had gone out and wrested what I wanted from the world. So I didn't know. All I did was, because I wanted to stay sober, was to stay long enough for it to work for me anyway, even though I didn't understand what anybody was talking about, because it doesn't make any difference. It's just like it doesn't make any difference who God is. The mail gets forwarded. All I know is that it is. All I know is that I trust more and more and more deeply a power in my life that directs me. All I know is that I get up and have gotten up for 16 years on a daily basis, whether I have wanted to or not, whether I have believed it was going to get any better, or even if I believed it was going to be worse today, I have gotten up and put me in shape and put my surroundings in shape, because I learned that early. My pride at being sober made me shave every day. My pride of looking sober made me dress well. That's where it all started. I had to have my surroundings in place because I got confused very quickly. And if the physical world that I was surrounded with was messy, my mind went crazy. I had to have things in place and my mind stayed in place. It was all the things that I had to learn to do in order to survive sober, because I had also become a suicidal. Which is only the natural for an alcoholic when he's got no place left to run. You know, what is a small, nasty child going to do when he is stamping his feet for what he wants? I mean, you have got to say, it's thy will, but if I don't get it in 24 hours, I'll kill myself. I didn't know that anybody else in here was suicidal. I didn't know that 90% of you are, you know. When I got here, you all just looked so well. I confused it like I had all my life as your being well. I had never understood the difference between people looking well and being sick. I had never gotten that message. I have gotten that message here. I was having problems with some people in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 5 years sober, and I had a wonderful sponsor, and we had a long talk about it, and he said, Donald, he said, number one, I want you to know, you're not dealing in a world of necessary well people. I have stayed here long enough to realize that was the grossest understatement of a century. And that's all right too. Because it's become all right for me not to be mentally well. Because I employ myself deeply enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to stay as balanced as is possible for me on a daily basis. I don't understand people who don't employ themselves at this program. It has taken everything. I can tell you the facts of what it was like crawling through an 18-room house naked in desperate search of something to drink so I wouldn't convulse again. And finally finding a stash of wine in a back closet or the servant's hallway, and breaking the necks of the bottles off and pouring it on my face because I wasn't able to walk, so I couldn't stand up. And the doorbell system had gone out in the rain, and the doorbells were going off, and I would just crawl to the door to see where the feet were underneath the doors. I can tell you all the facts of things like that. You know, I can tell you the facts of driving up to a liquor store and with the money to buy a quart of gin and being refused and getting down on my hands and knees crying and making him give it to me because it was bad for business. He gave it to me. Now let me tell you, that's not pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I got the quart of gin. But the problem with all of that is, when you're 16 years sober, you don't know what it feels like anymore. You don't know what you were feeling like. You don't know the horror of what's going on. And the horror of lying alone in a huge room, in a huge house. And it's all over, and it's all finished, and you keep trying to go on, and you keep trying to go on, and you keep trying to go on. And then they put you back in the nut house one more time. And finally you're not sober 3 months, and you're not sober 2 months, and you're not sober 2 weeks, and you're not sober 3 days. And suddenly they let you out, and you're sitting in the psychiatrist's office the next morning drunk. And he says, "How are you?" And you say, "I have half a pint of gin in my pocket." And he says, "Don't you think with your case history that's a little dangerous?" And you say to him, with total belief, "No, it's only half a pint." This is your 16th time in. And you come out another time and you're going to learn to drink like a drunk. And you come out another time and you're going to learn to drink like a gentleman. And you come out another time and they've pulled you together enough to send you to Europe on an assignment. And you go berserk in Europe. Absolutely berserk. And I was back here, and two station wagons pulled into that house, and I had a third of a bottle of gin down me in 4 seconds with great relief. It was the relief. It was the great relief of all time. And I remember that assignment. I was trying to back out of it, and it was a huge advance on a celebrity second book, a cookbook, with great geographic location value in it. And I had ended up on the coast of Italy, living in a villa, and what she had said to me when I tried to back out that assignment, and she doubled the advance, and she said, "I feel that you're really going through something frightening in your life." I mean, little did she know. I mean, I had that morning stood over the sink looking in the mirror saying, "How long can I get away with this? How long can I get away with coming out of that nut house and being drunk right away and then trying to hold on to it so you're not drinking during an assignment?" And she said, "I just want you to know that we want you, when you get to that villa, to stop and look out at the sky." And she said, "I feel your whole life is going to change and that everything is going to be all right and that you will have a new world." And I went berserk, I was back in the United States in 3 months, and 6 months later, I was finally in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a year and a half after that, 2 years after that, I had for the first night, it was a year and a half, 2 years later, the first night, I didn't go to a meeting, and I was frightened. I was frightened not going to a meeting, and we went to the Hollywood Bowl, a whole band of us, and we sat way up in the cheap seats, and they were playing the Pines of Rome. And I started to cry because I had the feeling that she was talking about, that this was the change, that this was the newness, and a whole life was starting, and I was sitting with three or four new people whom I called friends then, even though I still then didn't know what a friend was. And that was only a 25-cent bus ride and a $2 seat away. You know, it wasn't a $25,000 advance and 5,000 miles away. It was here in Los Angeles because I was sober. I've never treated the program of Alcoholics Anonymous lightly. And the reason I haven't is because it works. The thing of meetings was, someone asked me what time this meeting was tonight, and I didn't have to look in the book. Of course it was an 8:30 meeting. Of course it started by the people who started 8:30 meetings. It wasn't started 6:32 for 45 minutes. It's an 8:30 meeting for an hour and a half. That's what worked for me when I got here, was an hour and a half meeting. That you start off with chapter 5, and you end with the Lord's Prayer. And that was magic for me. You know that, and 60 cups of coffee and 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And this program has worked for me, and I believed it would from the beginning, and I believe it now. And I'm secretary of 2 meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sponsor a small band of people. They call themselves sponsored by the damned, you know. And it's true. Because I realize in Alcoholics Anonymous, the odds aren't with us. And I realize the miracle of being 16 years sober. I realize the miracle of being 2 days sober. I realize the miracle of being 1 year sober. I have realized that a miracle right down the line. But I also realize it's a miracle I still have to work for. Thank you.